This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an Airbus A350 captain who has a long history flying commercial aircraft. In the news, we consider one-person flight crews, U.S. airlines looking to scale back consumer protection regulations, ADS-B vulnerabilities for military aircraft, the largest ever Piper order for training planes, plans for the Air Force bomber fleet, and Southwest runs out of glycol. We also hear a conversation about ATIS with the chief of the Air Traffic Control Division at Robert Gray Army Airfield. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 490 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian who blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hi, everyone. We're still basking in the glow of my Eagles winning last week, but things have quieted down, so looking forward to a good show today.
You mention that every time I talk to you.
Well, you only got one more Thursday of listening to me talk about the Eagles, and okay. We'll move on to other things.
It's a deal. Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. I had a fun story. Yesterday, I was watching the Olympics and watching the Canadian ice skaters do their skating thing, and the song that they were ice dancing with, a friend of mine that I was watching the Olympics with said, "Hey, that's a United theme song." And I said, yes, you're right. It's also called Rhapsody in Blue. And they had no idea. So I thought that was very, very funny that it was just, it's like, why are the Canadians skating to the United theme song?
That's funny. I think a lot of people think that is the United theme song and that's it. So yeah, good. Yeah. All right. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He was off last week. Max is the host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He was a CFI of the year in 2008. He's also an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max, how are you?
Hey, I am awesome. And I just want to stand here side by side with David. I spent 5 years in the Philadelphia area. And so, yeah, long-suffering Eagles fan from the 70s. So I think that's awesome, too. So congratulations, David. We stand tall and proud together.
There you go. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening. And I'm not even going to complain from Chicago about the foot of snow we got last week, because I'm just ignoring it.
Oh, better you than all of us. Oh, my. Our guest this episode is Bill Palmer. Bill is an Airbus A350 captain. He's an instructor, pilot, Czech airman. He's been heavily involved in Airbus training since the early 1990s, and Bill is also the author of Understanding Air France 447, as well as other publications on Airbus flight control laws. Bill holds a commercial glider rating, and he flies his LS3 for fun in Southern California. That sounds like a blast. Bill, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be back.
Yeah, Bill was with us way back in episode 270 when we talked about Air France 447. Now, Bill, of course, you hold an ATP with a number of type ratings. Refresh us. What are those ratings that you have?
I have a DC-10, A330, A320, A350, 75767. I think that's it.
So you've been around commercial aviation for quite a while, and Bill, of course, can tell us a lot about the Airbus A350, which we're interested in, and also about flight control laws. So we'll be talking about those things coming up. But first, we just want to take a moment and thank those of you who've made donations to the Airplane Geeks podcast over the past year. It takes money to produce this podcast, things like website hosting, media hosting, even IT support, and we pay for these out of our pockets, so donations from you help us out. We wanted to send our thanks to Hendrik, Stephen, KTZR, Johns Philippe, Matthew, Frazier, Nathan, Antoine, two Johns and a Jonathan. We really appreciate the support. And if you'd like to make a donation to the Airplane Geeks podcast, please visit us at airplanegeeks.com. Scroll down to the donate button on the right-hand side. That will take you to a PayPal page where you can either make a one-time donation or a recurring monthly donation. And you can pay by PayPal or credit card or debit card. So again, we deeply appreciate your support and thank you.
Does that mean I don't have to sit on the corner on a chair with a styrofoam cup anymore, begging for money?
Maybe. No, you still have to do that.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Now it's time for the news. Is everybody ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
You betcha.
Our first story comes from The Guardian. This is Boeing floats idea of just one pilot in the cockpit. Well, at the Singapore Air Show, Boeing Research and Technology Vice President Charles Toop said, quote, "We are studying one pilot operations, and where you will first see that is probably in cargo transport, so the passenger question is off the table." Now, Boeing has been working with General Motors to develop technologies for autonomous flight. Boeing thinks that public support for that concept would be a step-by-step process, really starting with the proliferation of self-driving cars. So we've talked about this in the past. Usually we look at it from the standpoint of pilotless aircraft or aircraft, commercial aircraft, where there's not a pilot on board. But here we see thoughts along the lines of reducing from two pilots to one pilot. Rob, what do you think? Is this something that's inevitable?
Oh, I hate it when you ask me questions like that, because it always forces me to think of my my buddy that works over at FedEx. Every time they mention about the concept of starting with cargo pilots, and he says, what are we, chopped liver? We always seem to get the short end of the stick that makes it look like the cargo crews are not worth what the major airline, passenger airline crews are. I hate to say it, but I bet you that's probably going to happen. Maybe not in my lifetime, but I mean, I remember when there were four and then there were three and now there are two. And I just don't think the industry is going to be happy until it gets down to none.
Bill, one of the concerns I see from some pilots and other organizations is that the workload, the cockpit workload, is not really something that could be handled very well by one pilot. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that they're probably not talking about just taking one guy out of the current generation of aircraft. I mean, he used to fly single pilot, flying canceled checks around at night, you know, in a light twin. And, of course, that airplane was designed to be flown by one pilot, so it wasn't a big deal then. So the airplane that they'll be flying one pilot in would have to be designed or retrofitted or something for one pilot. And we don't have that now in any large aircraft. So we'll have to see what they come up with.
Yeah, that sounds like something that would be an expensive kind of retrofit. I mean, I think you're, you know, the concept that the cockpit would have to change is valid, and a retrofit just seems like something that would just be insanely expensive. I suppose it depends on the nature of the retrofit, but you know, if you're talking about then aircraft going forward, that sort of pushes this thing out pretty far in the future.
Well, you know, there's a lot of technologies now coming in with performance-based navigation, communication, CPDLC, ADS-B, you know, all these things that require less hands-on or, you know, fewer hands to be on during the flight. So, you know, that will help other technologies dovetail into each other to make it possible.
The motivation, at least in this article, for reducing the number of pilots in the cockpit is one of cost. And they talk about if we went to a one-pilot cockpit, it would save the airlines as tens of billions of dollars a year in pilot salaries and training costs. What do you guys think? Is that the real motivation behind this, reducing labor costs?
Maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think so, but I think it'll be interesting to see what either the insurance premiums will be in doing that, and or what happens after the first crash, and the NTSB decides that the factor was pilot overload, or you know, just too much going on in the cockpit and they couldn't deal with it all during an emergency. Yeah, the lawsuits from that, I think, will be monstrous and wipe out any of those savings.
Well, I don't think they know what it'll cost to do it, so it's kind of hard to determine that it's cheaper than what we currently have. You know, a lot of times the engineers are like, hey, look what I can do, you know, whether it's a good idea or not, you know?
Yeah, technology for its own sake. They bring up this notion of public acceptance of this idea is a process that starts with self-driving cars. That's kind of a thought that I've had before. And I'm not sure how successful self-driving automobiles, trucks, and will become. But I do think that if there is sort of a series of disastrous results with that, that will probably impact, or that could impact, the equivalent in aviation.
But it also means that they're waiting for old pilots to, like us, to die so that we won't be around to tell people, are you crazy? You're not going to get into that airplane with one pilot.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
You know, oddly, I think it's probably easier to automate an aircraft than a self-driving truck, because you don't have to worry about people walking in front of the airplane when it's, you know, in the flight level. So I think the problems are actually much bigger for self-driving trucks. I've got a client who works for a company that's doing self-driving trucks, and I think that's going to happen. It's interesting. They're actually looking at how to put more redundancy in trucks, because right now they just have a single electrical system. So it's like, whoa, you know what? We need a backup. We need extra batteries.
If you compare the automation for a self-driving car with an airplane, they're almost at opposite ends of the spectrum, because the airplane, when we program it into the FMS and we turn on the autopilot, it follows a route and does things that we could lay out, you know, many, many hours ahead of time. And it just follows this thing. And it really doesn't do anything dynamically. Mm-hmm. Now, there is one exception to that on the 350 that we'll talk about later. But it's just starting to creep in where the airplane can do some things on its own. But the self-driving car or truck or whatever, everything is dynamic. I mean, no matter how good the road database is, at any day, you know, a maintenance crew can come out and put up cones and set up trucks and have all these dynamic things, you know, like you said, people walking across, you know, red lights that you didn't know when they were going to come on, and all these things that the car has to process right at the moment, you know, and make all these decisions. And we've not seen anything like that in an airplane before.
Going back to public acceptance, I think that the public is going to accept very rapidly when they're given a choice for a ticket that costs X and a ticket with minus one pilot that's $10 less. They're just like, oh, yeah, I want the $10 less one with one pilot less.
Gosh.
So, no, seriously, I think people are just, that's all they care about is saving a nickel.
Yeah, it seems to be.
And we're already moving in that direction. There are a lot of light business jets that are already single pilot certified. The Honda jet, the Cirrus Vision Jet, the Phenoms, they're already here, and people are flying some Citation CJs, and I mean, they were designed to make everything easily accessible to the person in the left seat, as if they are the only person in the airplane.
All right, let's move on and look at an article. This is from San Francisco Gate, sfgate.com, airlines seeking to snuff traveler rights. This article, it references a Wall Street Journal article by Scott McCartney that reports that last October, the U.S. Department of Transportation asked airlines to suggest changes or cuts to regulations. Airlines for America filed 222 pages of comments. United Airlines added 50 pages on their own. And how they've responded, how the airlines have responded is kind of instructive. They're proposing or asking to to be considered things like dropping the 24-hour grace period for full refund when you buy a ticket, drop the rule that requires airlines to honor tickets sold for low fares by mistake, relief from the requirement to promptly provide a wheelchair, eliminate the requirement to disclose when airline booking systems exclude competitors' flights, drop the requirement to show on-time cancellation data with flights, the tarmac delay rule. There are several others. You know, it's a list of the consumer protection requirements, regulations that we've seen come in the last few years. Now, we don't know how or even if the DOT will respond to these. But what do you guys think? Brian is our frequent flyer, at least in the back of the plane. How do you react to this?
Yeah, I think we made such progress over the years in really defending passengers' rights, and I just see them being quickly eroded away and going back to the good old days of flying. He says, tongue in cheek, where. Yeah, the airlines can be as ruthless. Hate using the phrase. Yeah, I was going to say deceptive as possible, but sometimes they're not being deceptive. I don't think that's their intent, but that ends up being the result. So hiding the fares, if, for example, there's a fuel surcharge and that not being disclosed up front in the ticket price, or fees for baggage or fees for whatever. So the passengers don't have a reasonable idea of what the ticket's going to charge. If the airline has a reasonable way of getting the plane back to the gate and they choose to have you sit out on the tarmac for more than 3 hours, I just think that borders on cruel and unusual punishment to passengers. And these regulations did really make the airlines think differently and treat the passengers better. And unfortunately, the current administration, I could see these all going away.
You mean to tell me you think that service could get worse at United?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
On every airline, it could get worse. Absolutely.
And I didn't even realize that the 24-hour grace period was regulated. I took advantage of that this past weekend. I've got a trip coming up, and it got shifted a day. So fortunately, it was less than 24 hours. No penalty. So, this is going to just put more money in the pockets of the airlines.
Yeah, if you have to pay $300 to change your ticket, that'll hurt.
I don't know if I don't defend any one of these particular policies being eliminated, but, you know, I have to look at it from the point of view that the administration is saying, hey, let's cut regulations, and the businesses are saying, hey, these particular regulations cost us money. What do you think? I mean, you know, they've already cut regulations to allow you to pollute streams, for crying out loud. Mm.
I agree.
So, and then what market forces will, you could eliminate the regulation, but who's going to, maybe the first airline, maybe it's a line they don't want to cross to eliminate certain policies, just marketing wise.
Well, we're down to what? Basically four airlines. That's pretty much an oligopoly. So I think if one of them moves in one direction, the others will quickly match whatever it is. So, yeah, I don't think there are enough airlines out there to really cause competition. So I think they really can move lockstep and, place these greater burdens on the flying public, which, given the choice between, voting for the airlines or voting for the public, I kind of vote for the public.
Well, the Wall Street Journal also points out that one of the things asked for is clearer rules about emotional support animals. Of course, we've been talking about that and seeing that in the press. Seems like each week there's a new emotional support animal story.
Oh, but the peacock was probably one of the best, wasn't it?
Yeah. Come on. I mean, the iguana was denied, I think.
The iguana? Okay. I did like the peacock.
Bill, have you ever had to step in and address an emotional support animal issue?
Not personally, no.
Good. You're probably happy about that.
Yes, I am. There are all kinds of stories. The problem is that it's thought that people are taking advantage of the emotional support animal to avoid paying otherwise fees for carrying animal in the cabin that could be, pretty hefty. and some animals would not otherwise be allowed. You know, it just got to the point where, okay, this is getting crazy, you know?
Yeah, a few people are potentially ruining it for, you know, those that do have a real need.
Yeah, did I mention my emotional support hippo?
Yeah, that would be a real trick. Next item, this comes from The Aviationist. Vulnerable to cyber attacks, ADS-B may expose F-22s to web-based tracking, GAO warns. So the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, has a report out, a 45-page report, that says that neither the Department of Defense nor the FAA have taken significant steps to mitigate security risks associated with openly transmitting flight data from military aircraft. And the article explains, and David, you can jump in, that the military aircraft also have transponders like commercial aircraft, but usually they're turned off when they're engaged in real operations. But sometimes that doesn't happen. There have been some cases where actual, you know, military flights and even Air Force One has been tracked at, you know, the usual tracking sites, Plane Finder, Flight Radar 24, things like that. And with ADS-B, the notion here is that, you know, people may be able to track military flights, and the FAA hasn't really dealt with that enough. David, do you have any thoughts on this one?
It's a security risk, but it seems to be an across-the-board security risk. They do actually go into the fact that we've tracked Russian aircraft, we've tracked other specialized aircraft and their missions via flight radar. And this is one of those unanticipated technologies that a lot of us use, and it's going to have to be figured out. I mean, there's going to probably have to be some ADS-B frequencies that will be given directly to the military so they have blocked from viewing these things. But you also need the ADS-B. You can't eliminate the ADS-Bs because you are flying in the national airspace. It's like we talk about on UAV Digest about UASs. You want to be able to interact with the civilian airspace as well. So it's going to be a back and forth. But when you're flying in an operational area, you definitely do not want your enemy to go pull out their iPhone and say, "Oh, look, there's four F-22s coming towards us."
Right.
Or more to the point, they talk about the C-32B, which is a special operations aircraft based out of 757, based out of McGuire. And that's for deploying anti-terrorism and Department of Defense people. And it has a very clandestine mission, but it's shown up on ADS-B and people go, "Oh, look, what's it doing in North Africa?" Which leads all sorts of other questions. So it all depends upon, there's a time and a place for it, but there's got to be a way to shut it off too.
One quote here is, "The approach being taken by FAA and DOD will not address key security risks that have been identified, and delays in producing an interagency agreement have significantly reduced the time available to implement any agreed-upon solutions before January 1st, 2020, when the full deployment of ADS-B out is required." When I read that, they throw in the notion that time is short and maybe there's not enough time to figure this out. I wonder if that might ultimately lead to pushing out the 2020 mandate, or maybe used as an excuse to push that out. But I don't know. I'm just sort of speculating.
Is this just a matter of they forgot to turn it off when they're on a military mission?
I guess in some cases, yes. There was a case cited in the Libya air war in 2011 where some of the combat aircraft either forgot or failed to switch off their MODES or ADS-B transponders, and they were tracked. There's also an example of a military airplane over Afghanistan in 2014 that was tracked. So it does happen.
Yeah, but if it's electronic or mechanical, I could also see just the system failing to turn off. So even if the pilot presses the right switch or button or whatever, it could still not turn off. So
that's pretty remote. I'd say it's more of a checklist problem.
Sure, but it could happen.
It's a checklist problem. When you're going into combat, you're on adrenaline and stuff, and it's one of those things that you have to go through and turn off, or God forbid the Pentagon and the F-22s and the F-35s have an automatic shut off when they load the data into their aircraft for the mission. Most of mission profiles now are loaded via basically a disk into the computer that maps out their flight planning. And one of the things it might do is turn off the ADS-B given the mission. If that's the case, then there's a real problem. But I would hope that the Air Force hasn't automated so much in the new aircraft that this kind of thing would happen inadvertently because the system failed.
Well, you know, if they're operating outside of a restricted area in airspace with other aircraft, other civilian aircraft, you know, they need to have it on. You know,
yeah,
plain and simple. You know, it's replacing radar. You can't just have them flying around invisible.
Historically, what's really interesting is the F-117s had what they call bricks. They had two very large pieces of metal that they slapped on the sides of the intakes to suddenly make it visible to radar when flying in the continental U.S. The air shows and stuff, you'll see that this object that's on that didn't look like it fit was what was designed to act as a large-scale beacon on the aircraft for the radar to pick up. So ADS-B is just a new electronic version of it, but those bricks came off when the 117s flew in combat.
Hopefully they didn't forget to take the bricks off.
Oh, believe me, the bricks were only on when necessary.
Yeah.
They were more off than on.
All right, a general aviation story from Flying Magazine. Piper receives largest training order in company history. Chinese Fanmei Aviation Technologies has ordered 152 training aircraft from Piper Aircraft. Now, Fanmei is Piper's dealer in China. They're a subsidiary of a rather large Fanmei education group that provides aviation education in China. And this is reported to be the single largest order for training airplanes in Piper's history. It's a lot of airplanes, 100 Archer TX single-engine trainers, 50 twin-engine Seminoles, one Seneca twin, and one Piper M350, with deliveries starting soon, next month, in March. So this is good news for Piper Aircraft.
It sure is. Heck is. In what I did, Steve Pope wrote that story, I think, and
yeah,
I went back and looked at some of the data, and we couldn't find any even remotely recent orders from any other manufacturer, as in the name of Textron, that came even close to almost 160 airplanes. And it certainly is the largest order in modern times, although my guess is if we went back and looked at aviation back in the late 70s or 80s, we might have seen some large orders for aircraft. But again, this is a big deal. But again, all of it going to China.
One thing we should point out is it's a 7-year deal. So it equates to about 20 airplanes a month. So initially, a year rather. So a couple airplanes a month. So yeah, in total, $74 million. Big deal, spread over time, so it's not quite the impact. But I think most importantly, it kind of signals that something has changed in China. We have heard for years that GA is about to take off. You know, for literally 10 years, we've been hearing this. So maybe something has fundamentally changed, because you know, you've got to have some real demand for flight schools and aircraft to have an order like this.
And Max, do you think that all these pilots are going to they will be Chinese nationals and staying in China, or do you think that they're trying to turn themselves into a training machine and export these pilots as well?
Well, I think they'll certainly start as all Chinese nationals and probably be that way for a long time. But yeah, there may come a time when they decide to, you know, get into the export business. But I think they've got enough demand there that they'll keep it mostly internal. I mean, the big challenge, I think, and this has always been, I think, the issue is, you know, when the average visibility is less than 3 miles, it's going to make VFR flight training a little challenging, because when you're practicing stalls and steep turns, it helps to have a clearly defined horizon out there. So they're going to have their work cut out figuring out how to teach VFR maneuvers.
Well, that's not the whole country. there's a couple of factors there. I think, you know, the average person in China, their income is a lot higher than it was decade or two ago. They have a increasing commercial aviation sector, and very little in the way of experienced domestic pilots to count on. So their economy may be supporting it, and it's probably probably all be Chinese pilots flying it. By the way, what is the how many airplanes is Piper producing annually or yearly or monthly or whatever for the current general aviation market?
Yeah. Can you look that up while we speak?
All right. Well, yeah, because that's a really good question. To see how much of an increase in the production rate would this represent? It's probably big. But I spent some time looking at some of the Fanmei websites, which are in Chinese. But it turns out Google Translate can do a pretty good job of translating the Chinese. And I found that this Sichuan Pan American Education Investment Group owns more than 8 billion yuan in educational assets. That's about $1.3 billion U.S. Is affiliated with 9 aviation colleges, more than 45,000 students. In the future, they'll also set up an aeronautical applied undergraduate college, or that's their plan. And then they have something in this. You know, it's a translation, so I'm not sure it's a pure translation, but the heading is 100 Years Pan American Advocates New Concept of Public Welfare Education. This group wants to create the world's largest public education group. Three-step strategic plan. First step is to build 6 universities, 12 secondary vocational schools, and dozens of training brands across the country. This is all aviation. The second step is to set up Hong Kong University of Science and Technology as a base and build 12 public service science and technology universities across the country. The third step is to open a new campus in, get ready for this, the United States, Singapore, United Arab Emirates, to establish 3 international brands, training of aviation personnel in the world, in Asia and Africa and other countries less educated, to establish a comprehensive, they call it public welfare university. There are big plans underfoot for China, and you know, to get to Brian's point, I think starting in China to meet the demand that they have in country, but it really does look like they have their sights set on becoming a worldwide provider of these kinds of training and education services. So it's fascinating.
I do have those numbers from Piper, and in 2016, which is the most complete year Piper recorded with the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, it looks like in the realm of piston propeller powered airplanes, maybe Piper produced 70, but that's excluding the high-performance M350, they produced 26 of those, but that's not they only ordered 1 for this current group to China. But again, it looks like maybe they were building about 70 training airplanes a year before this order. So it looks like it could go up, 10, 15, 20% perhaps to keep things going at the same pace.
Yeah, and revenue-wise, the billings were about $150 million last year, so this adds about $10 million per year.
That's a nice bump. We have a story from the U.S. Air Force. Air Force outlines future of bomber force. And we see from the fiscal year 2019 budget request that the Air Force has outlined its plans for its bomber fleet, which includes a plan to update the B-52 Stratofortress fleet, continue modifications to the B-1 Lancer and B-2 Spirit fleets, and continue to acquire B-21 Raiders. David, that B-21 Raider, that's the new, Northrop Grumman bomber?
That's correct. It's a faster, cheaper B-2. It's what the B-2 was supposed to be, but we only purchased so many of them. What's absolutely striking about this is when the B-21 comes online in the 2020s, you would think that the oldest aircraft in the inventory would be the first to be replaced.
You would, wouldn't you? However,
the first aircrafts to be replaced by the B-21 will actually be the B-2s, followed by the B-1s. So the old saying when the B-2 came out and the B-1 came out was, when they retire the B-1s to the boneyard, or when they retire the B-2s to the boneyard, they're going to be flown home by B-52s pilots. Well, this is going to be, they're looking to fly the B-52 until the 2060s.
Amazing.
So these aircraft will be over 100 years old. The B-1 does not have a nuclear strike capability anymore. The B-52 does, and the B-2 does. The B-1 now is a conventionally armed aircraft and is not capable of dropping a nuclear weapon, which is why they're going to phase them out. This is all part of the new restructuring of our nuclear weapons programs, but this is the fallout of. The B-2, of course, is, while probably the greatest bomber flying right now, is also the most expensive bomber to fly right now. And the B-21 is literally a direct replacement and will have all of the capabilities that the B-2 does, because the B-21 is a flying wing with stealth. But nothing beats that truck that Boeing built, and we will be flying B-52s till the end of time. I'm sure eventually, Elon Musk will figure out a way of putting rocket engines on them, and they will be our suborbital bombers.
David, why is this the B-21? Why isn't this the B-3?
Because somebody in the Pentagon decided that it was a 21st century bomber.
Interesting.
So B-21. And also, just because we're being hokey, what's 2 + 1?
Oh, 3. Oh, you think they thought of that actually, or do you think it just sort of?
Yes, oh. I've seen that commented on, but really, it's the 21st century bomber.
And the Raider part of the name?
Well, it's based on the Jimmy Doolittle Raiders, the Tokyo Raiders. The aircraft is named after the B-25s that bombed Japan off of the Hornet, the Doolittle Raiders. And that's where they got the Raider from. It's in honor of the Doolittle Raiders.
All right. The Tier 1 suppliers for this program are interesting, starting off with Pratt & Whitney, also BAE Systems, Spirit Aerosystems, Orbital ATK, Rockwell Collins, GKN Aerospace, and Janicki Industries. The last one was one I wasn't too familiar with, but they're a composites tooling and parts company. So those are the Tier 1 suppliers for this program. All right, one final item, and this is in honor of Rob for the snowfall he's been receiving there in Chicago. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Day after massive flight cancellations, Southwest says Midway flights, quote, close to normal. Rob, how did they go abnormal?
They ran out of de-icer fluid. unfortunately, and it's funny, Bill and I were talking about this earlier this afternoon, and about how much they use, how much fluid they use to de-ice an airplane these days. And I was in one a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was just me that sort of got the impression that they had absolutely drowned this 737 before we took off. And then, Bill, I think you had a similar thought on that, didn't you?
Exactly. It looked like there was a little bit of snow on the wing, and they used a lot more than it appeared to me from inside the cabin than would have been required.
Yeah, so that's probably why they ran out. Plus, of course, Midway is one of Southwest's largest hubs, so there's a lot of traffic there.
And don't they recycle the de-ice fluid? Doesn't it? I mean, it gets captured, doesn't it? It's not like it runs off into the storm sewer.
It does get captured, yes.
I don't know if they reuse it, though.
I don't know if they reuse it, but it is captured. It doesn't just run off into a nearby stream.
Yeah, one would hope not. Again, we're speaking with Bill Palmer. He's an A350 captain. Bill, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you.
We want to get into the A350 a little bit, but because you've flown so many other aircraft, how do you compare the A350 to the others?
It's like going from DOS to Windows.
Really? It's that big a jump, huh?
The core functions are the same. You know, they're all in there, but the interface is different. And, you know, update it. That's probably a pretty good analogy, I think.
It's well known that the A350 started out as the A350, then became the AWB, extra wide body, after some of the airlines, some of the potential customers wanted to see a little bit more from Airbus. Do you have a feeling like Airbus stepped up and delivered to those airlines what they were looking for?
I think their initial plan was to just kind of soup up the 330. But as the 787 development encountered, they realized that that was not going to work. And so the 350 was, it's, you know, internally, a lot of it is a two engine 380. You know, there's a lot of cockpit commonality with the 380, a lot of systems commonality with the 380. So they definitely learned a lot from that. And have improved on that lesson. So, you know, like all airplanes, none of them are completely from scratch. But it's a very nice evolution.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when you're sitting up front in cruise, Bill, I mean, is it noticeably quieter in the 350 up high than it was in the 330?
It's quieter than the 330, but what you need to compare it to is an aircraft of equivalent speed, which is Mach 0.85, which would be the 747, which is much, much quieter than that. So, I mean, if you look at the profile of the nose, it's very smooth. None of the flight deck windows open. You know, it's much more contoured, kind of a smooth contour, I guess.
And, of course, the 350's got a much more attractive fuel burn than the old 747s.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a fair way to compare it would be per passenger, and it's, you know, 25 or 30% less, considering that, you know, it carries about three quarters of the passengers of the 7-4 and burns about, you know, half the fuel or maybe a little bit more than half the fuel. And it just depends on what metric you want to use, you know.
And what about some of the enhancements to flight control? What are some of the differences that are featured in the A350?
Well, the 350 starts with the basic Airbus flight control laws that have been in existence since the A320 in the early 90s and adds to it. They just work a little bit better in the A330 and those generations earlier. As we've seen with a couple of incidents and accidents, when things go wrong, you know, multiple computers fail or it's got bad information or whatever, the autopilot has clicked off and said, you got it, you know, kind of at the worst possible moment. The A350, the autopilot works a lot more. It'll work with a dual engine failure, a emergency electrical configuration, complete hydraulic failure. The autopilot still works. It has an extended envelope. So instead of disconnecting at 45 or 60 degrees of bank, it can stay on to 120 degrees of bank, up to 50 degrees nose up pitch, into overspeed, into the stall warning, and has a built-in protection envelope that it tries to bring it back into the normal flight envelope. It's not quite an upset recovery program, but at least it gives the pilot a few more seconds that he can take over when he's ready, instead of being handed to him when he's not ready. That's some of the enhancements. It's much more robust.
Bill, tell us a little bit about how the flight control laws work into all this. What does that mean? We hear about these flight control laws. Can you explain what that concept is?
Okay, well, the laws are computer programs. So in a conventional airplane, if you move the stick or the control column, the ailerons in the elevator and the rudders with the pedals move in a directly proportional manner. So with a fly-by-wire aircraft, which is the flight controls are controlled by computers, you can design it so that it can behave however you want. And so in the Airbus line, with the side stick controller, when the pilot moves the side stick left and right, instead of being an aileron command, it commands rate of roll. When the pilot produces a forward and back on the side stick, instead of being a elevator command, it's a pitch rate or G load. So with the flight control laws, it allows the airplane to fly very consistently, no matter what your weight, no matter what your speed, and build in protections so that you can't intentionally flip it upside down or pitch too high or go too slow or go too fast. So it allows you to command a performance. For example, if you look up and there's a mountain in front of you, you can just pull all the way back on the stick and know that you will get the maximum performance and you will not be in danger of stalling or breaking the airplane. In an airplane that does not have these protections, you have to try to figure out how much you can pull back before you break things or stall it. And studies show that pilots won't pull back as far as they can. They don't really know where the limit is, and may not be able to get the maximum performance out of it in those emergency situations. So it allows you to apply instinctive reactions on the flight controls, full controlled deflection without danger of stall or structural damage.
Hmm. Now, sometimes the flight control law that's in effect can change based on certain circumstances.
Yeah, so it needs to have redundant data, usually triple redundant data, to be in the highest level of a flight control law. It's called normal law, which is where it operates, nearly 100% of the time. If that data is compromised, either because a sensor was clogged or broken or something, then it's designed so that it's not going to operate, have all this authority to limit pilot input based on data that's not redundant. So in the different generations of aircraft, the 320, 330, 350, each one has come a little bit more. You can imagine what your computer was like in 1980. I mean, if you had a computer, it probably had two floppy drives and a 300 baud modem, that you connected to CompuServer and thought it was really fantastic.
It was. It was marvelous.
It was, right? So compare it to what we have now. So we see the evolution in the computing power, and the capabilities of the airplane are reflective of the respective increase in the computing capability over that time period.
Do we see much retrofitting? I mean, continuing the computer analogy, sometimes we'll put a newer version of the operating system on the computer we have, but eventually you just have to throw up your hands and say, okay, we're just going to buy a new computer and it'll work better than trying to patch and upgrade this old one. Is it the same with airplanes?
I think the certification issue gets in the way a little bit if it's certified with one thing. There are capabilities that you can retrofit into the earlier Airbus, different models, functions like brake to vacate and some of the runway overrun warning functionalities that can be retrofitted. But I'm not really sure where the line is there.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. You know, going back to Air France 447, I think there was at the time conversations about the flight control laws and so forth in that flight. Are there lessons that we learned from that terrible accident that have been applied in the newer versions of the flight control laws or in the aircraft themselves?
You know, of course, Airbus doesn't say it in so many words, but my impression is that that accident was taken very seriously. So on the A350, the airspeed redundancy is very robust. If you lose all the pitot tubes, you know, it switches automatically to backup systems, and it can even go to engine data to provide a backup airspeed indication, which is pretty remarkable. In fact, you know, the FAA wanted us to be able to turn, you know, to fail all the airspeeds for simulator training. And it was like, we don't know how to turn enough things off to do that. So it's much more redundant and much more robust, like I said. Additionally, like I mentioned before, the autopilot tends to stay on, or at least you can re-engage it up to, you know, some pretty extreme ends of the flight envelope. Like Air France 447, when the flight control law degraded to alternate law because of the loss of or disagreement of all the airspeed indications, you know, the autopilot clicked off and the autothrust turned off and the crew was handed the airplane. Well, the 350, not only will you probably not degrade the airspeed what it was, but the autopilot tends to stay on much more. So, you know, until the crew is ready to hand fly it, if in fact they need to hand fly it at all.
Hmm. So, Bill, tell us a little bit about the training that you're conducting at your airline.
So it's a normal transition course. So there's a ground school portion, there's a simulator portion, and I'm a line check instructor. So I take the new A350 pilot with him on his first several trips where we, you know, review everything, and he gets to land the real airplane and, you know, operate it in a real line environment.
So are these revenue flights?
Yes. Well, some are and some are not. So we also have occasional just training flights, but mostly the revenue flights. And that's standard for the entire industry.
Bill, is there any difference between the 900 and the 1000 model?
You know, I'm not an expert on the 1000, but it's longer. I think it'll go farther. It's got bigger engines and it's got three landing gear in a row instead of two. So it's heavier aircraft.
So there are some differences in the flight deck then?
I think the flight deck is going to be, you'd probably have a hard time figuring out which one you were sitting in.
Okay.
Bill, what can you tell us about the types of student pilots that you encounter at the airline? Is this a young group, an experienced group? What do they look like?
They're very handsome.
Especially in uniform, right?
Yes. And, well, we get a quite a range. The A350, of course, is the, replaces the 747. It's the top aircraft, you know, at any airline. So we get the pilots coming off the 747 as well as any other aircraft. So there's quite a variety. Some have had previous Airbus experience, some have not. So it's quite a diverse group.
Is there any competition or between going with a 777 or a 787?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Well, as far as the pilots deciding which to upgrade to,
I don't know. Everybody has their own different motivation. You know, one is based in one city versus another, versus whether they've flown all Boeing all their life or whether they've flown all Airbus all their life. Or everybody has their own desires and reasons, and they're not all the same. And thank goodness.
All right. Well, Bill, is there anything else that our audience might be interested in concerning the A350?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about a couple of the features that we do find on the A350 that are pretty interesting. One is it brings in kind of a realistic implementation of a paperless cockpit. So we have the electronic flight bag. Instead of being just an iPad that's, you know, stuck on the windowsill, there's a computer, whether it's a laptop or an iPad or whatever, could be any number of type of devices, plugs into the airplane, and it can receive data from the airplane so it can know what malfunctions have occurred. and other data like that. So software running on that laptop can run more real-time performance and landing calculations, for example, you know, taking into account anything that has, you know, malfunctioned in the meantime. So this displays on the permanent screens that are outside of each pilot's seat. It's very similar to the A380's layout, except, you know, this is a different class of EFB, which allows a little bit more customization than I believe the A380 had. Hmm. It has a really nice feature that is built into the airport navigation function, which displays a detailed map on each pilot's navigation display, which has every taxiway, every gate, you know, all this airport and runway data built into the system. And that allows the pilot to select which taxiway he wants to turn off on, and the airplane will land and then brake in order to vacate on that particular taxiway. You can adjust the runway condition, whether it's by braking action or runway condition, whether it's, you know, dry, wet, snow, ice, whatever. And it'll calculate the landing distance, and then you can select which taxiway you want to get off on, and it'll brake accordingly to slow you to 10 knots just before that exit. Hmm. So that saves a lot on brake wear. It'll tell you, you know, exactly how many seconds you'll be on the runway to do that. So it's really excellent tool. Built into that is also a predictive feature called a runway overrun warning or runway overrun protection, which not only looks at all the information you've given it as far as what the wind is, what your approach speed is going to be, what your flap setting is going to be, but below a low altitude around 400 feet, it switches to a dynamic assessment where it looks where you really are. You know, are you high on the glide slope? Are you fast on the approach? You know, does it look like you're going to land long and overrun, in which case it can warn you that you need to go around, or that the runway is too short, you know, and you need to use maximum braking or maximum reverse? It's quite an interesting system.
Sounds really, really powerful. How accurate is it? I mean, is it dead nuts on every time, or is there some variation in it? I'm kind of curious. I mean, it seems like there's so many factors involved, so many variables, that to sort of automate that, is it that precise?
Well, those calculations are already done with other software as far as, you know, given the runway condition and the winds and all these other factors,
yeah,
what is your landing distance going to be? So it just, it's not new math. It's just nice that it's presented to you in a graphic way, and it takes information from the airplane that you've already plugged into the airplane. You don't have to program it into another separate calculator device and come up with it separately. It can be dynamic. So that's a new functionality. You know, your calculator doesn't know if you're high on the glide slope or fast on the approach. You know, so it's a That's a nice feature. So it seems to be accurate. The brake to vacate works very well. You know, conventionally you might land and put the brakes on and then take them off and then put them on again to turn off on the taxiway. This allows the airplane to land. You use reverse, you know, aerodynamic slowing down, and then at the end it'll put on whatever brakes are necessary to turn off at that taxiway. Of course, if you select a turn off that's very near, you know, the shorter distance that you can land in, then the brakes will come on right away in order to do it. And it can be very aggressive if you need it to be. Or you can say, well, I'm going to turn off at the taxiway closest to my gate.
Bill, are there some other capabilities of the A350 auto flight system that we didn't talk about before that are particularly interesting?
Yeah, the A350 auto flight system does have a couple capabilities that kind of extend beyond those things where that you can anticipate many hours in advance, like the route of flight. These are the automatic TCAS and wind shear recovery. So these might seem to stray into the more dynamic aspect of the self-driving car arena, where things are handled as they come. So the A350 autoflight system has the ability to perform a TCAS resolution advisory maneuver on the autopilot without pilot intervention. TCAS, of course, is the traffic collision advisory system, and the resolution advisory is the point in a maneuver where a maneuver is required to avoid a collision. So even if all of the automation is completely off, if a resolution advisory occurs, the flight directors and autothrust will automatically engage to assist hand-flying the maneuver. The autoflight system, whether it's autopilot or just flight directors, then returns the airplane to the altitude it started at or resumes the previous climb or descent before the TCAS maneuver began. So the procedure of most other aircraft is to turn everything off, autopilot, flight directors, autothrust, and hand-fly the maneuver on raw data. So on the A350, when a traffic advisory occurs, which is the precursor to the resolution advisory, the crew can decide to be ready to hand-fly the maneuver or let the autopilot do it. And the autopilot does a very nice job at it because it's really a pretty well-defined maneuver when that occurs. The other enhanced function is the capability to fly a wind shear escape maneuver while on the autopilot. Now, most other aircraft will disconnect the autopilot when the angle of attack gets very high, like in a wind shear situation. But the A350's extended autopilot envelope allows it to continue to work and to attempt to maintain airspeed, a minimum climb gradient, and all within maximum angle of attack floor to ensure you get maximum performance and stall protection throughout the wind shear maneuver.
When you're training pilots on the A350, I imagine that these kinds of capabilities are featured quite heavily in the training, and they can represent a change for some of the pilots compared to what they're used to, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so, of course, we train them. They can hand-fly the maneuver, and they also train them to see that the autopilot can do a nice job as well. You know, when the traffic advisory enunciates, TCAS actually becomes an armed mode, and the crew will call out, you know, TCAS armed, and then decide if they want to hand fly it or let the autopilot do it.
In practice, what do you think most pilots do? Do they opt for the hand fly option or let the autopilot take a spin at it? What do you think pilots prefer to do?
Well, I think that for the TCAS, it would probably let the autopilot do it because it's following prescribed guidance that's displayed on the vertical speed indicator. So, you know, it's not like the pilot has to wing it. You know, it's pretty defined, the pitch rate that you have to perform and the rate of climb or descent that you have to perform. So there's really not a lot of judgment involved. But the other aircraft don't have that built into the flight director or autopilot guidance, so that's not even an option. So here it does, it's a very gently flown, nice maneuver. The wind shear might be one where the pilot says, you know what, I think I'm going to fly this one. Probably more up just because it's such a threatening situation. And but, you know, the autopilot does do a nice job of that, too. So it's hard to say. It might depend on the individual pilot's background.
Bill, I'm starting to really appreciate your analogy from the beginning of the show where you said it's like going from DOS to Windows. A lot of capabilities here with this A350.
It's a very nice airplane.
Okay. I want to give you an opportunity, certainly, to just mention some of the books that you've written and where our listeners can go to find those.
Yeah, my most popular one, of course, is Understanding Air France 447. I also have two other books on the Airbus flight control laws that are just, they're smaller. One is the normal law, and the second is the reconfiguration laws. So these are available on wherever you can buy ebooks. For example, Amazon.com, Smashwords, and other ebook retailers. You can also buy the hard copy for Air France. Understanding Air France 447 is also available at Amazon.com primarily, or on my website at understandingaf447.com. If you want a signed copy.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, we'll have those links in the show notes for sure. And Bill, we want to thank you for coming on the show again. It was a great conversation. The A350 sounds exciting, and I suspect that you're thoroughly enjoying flying that aircraft.
Yeah, I certainly am. Thank you very much for having me. You know, one of the things I did last April and we're going to do again this April is what's called Wave Camp, is go up and fly the mountain wave in just south of Reno, Nevada, in a glider.
Ooh, yeah, because you're a glider guy.
Glider guy, yeah. You know, so last year I got up to 27,000 feet in that, and I mean, that's pretty wild, you know. And I think, you know, soaring is so cool, and you know, I'd like to do whatever I can to help promote the interest in it, and that is one really cool thing to do with it.
So, does that require a lot of preparation? And you know, are there a lot of people who do that? You know, ride that thing like that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it has to be in the right place, and the conditions have to be right, of course. And it's primarily for people who have not flown in WAVE before, though they do get quite a few repeat visitors. And they bring in, you know, they have instructors and they have a meteorologist. And so, in fact, they had the Pearland 2 there as a, you know, that's where its base is when it's not in South America. So we got to see that and fly its simulator and stuff. And that's primarily a WAVE operated aircraft as well, you know. And then so they take you up into the WAVE, and they have a special window that goes up into the Class A airspace that they have a agreement with the air traffic control center, that you can have this WAVE window open, this block of airspace, that you can then fly up to 28,000 feet in it without having to have a flight plan or be talking to ATC all the time and stuff, you know. So it's pretty wild.
What is it about a glider that really is most appealing to you?
You know, it's very basic.
Yeah.
I guess it's, you know, it's always a challenge to, you know, in an airplane, you're taking off from point A and you're going to point B, and you're just, you know, the weather is something you just poke through. You know, in a glider, all your energy is derived from the weather and from understanding where the air is going up and where the air is going down and what's the best speed to fly for whatever situation. So it's really being in tune with everything around you. You know, the glider's performance, you know, what is the proper speed to fly for this particular situation? You know, finding, you know, the thermals that we climb in are invisible, and you have to try to figure out where they're at and to center on them. And so it's a challenge, and it's you know, it's beautiful, you know, it's fun to fly, and it's all for fun. It's not just, you know, oh, we got to go from here to there, you know. It's,
yeah,
it's to go up and have a good time. And you know, there's a huge community of racing and competition, and you know, at all different levels, you know, cross country flying, which I'm just starting to get into a little bit. You know, where the guys go with a glider with no engine there and back, you know, hundreds of miles, is just like, you know, amazing.
There's a purity to it that's kind of unique, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all you.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. Max Trescott, you were away last week and couldn't make the show. Doing anything interesting?
I've been flying like crazy, sometimes 7 days a week. But yeah, look, I'm headed out to Knoxville on Wednesday to bring back a brand new SR-22T for a customer who unfortunately is out of the country and can't be there to pick it up. So that's going to be a fun flight to bring it back. And I would say I could have sold that other seat up front multiple times.
I bet.
You know, for those long flights, it's just always much nicer to have somebody else up there with me rather than being alone for the whole thing. So found a gentleman who's just recently checked out in an SR-22 and is thinking of buying one. So I thought, let's take him back to the factory and see what he thinks of it. So that was kind of fun. And I just heard today from AOPA. They had invited me to teach a couple IFR seminars at their fly-ins that they're going to be holding around the country later this year. So those regional fly-ins are kind of a key way that AOPA reaches out to their membership to allow them to, you know, come in and hear things from different manufacturers and seminars and things like that. So you can find all the locations on AOPA, but it's going to be starting in June up in Missoula, Montana, and then running around the rest of the country. I guess we're going to be in Carbondale, Illinois, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Gulf Shores, Alabama at various times in the year. So I'm looking forward to meeting people who come out to the AOPA flying at those locations.
And you're going to be at all four of those?
I am, yes. So wow. The main event is on Saturday, and they've set it up so that there are series of seminars on Friday. So I'll be there on the Fridays to teach the seminars. We've got a 3-hour kind of refresher, you know, beginner, if you will, IFR course, and then a more advanced GPS IFR discussion in the afternoon.
Very good. All right. That sounds great. Brian, I understand you had some kind of an interesting sighting the other day.
Yeah, well, it started off with a sound at first. It was something that I wasn't really familiar with. I've heard a lot of jets fly overhead because when they take off from LAX and go to Europe, they're usually pretty high. This time it was definitely low, kind of sounded like a helicopter, kind of sounded like a plane. And it ended up being two Osprey that were flying overhead, not the bird, but the helicopter plane bird. And it was really, really interesting to see them. And the rotors were not in the plane position, and they weren't in the helicopter position. They were kind of in between, but they were still moving fast. So it was really interesting. It was the first time I ever saw them outside of an air show flying around overhead. So that was definitely a fun sighting.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Are they very loud?
Yes, they were. They were fairly close as well, so maybe that contributed to it. But it was just an unusual sound because it didn't, and maybe David could talk about this, because it didn't sound like an airplane and it didn't sound like a helicopter. Here in Pasadena, we have the police force has 4 or 5 helicopters, and they fly overhead a lot, so I'm used to hearing them. But this was definitely different. And all the neighbors were all abuzz as well about this unusual sighting.
Did they know what it was, or were they?
No.
Yeah, yeah.
Down here in San Diego, where we're close to Miramar Air Station, there's quite a few of them. I see them fly overhead regularly. They have a unique sound.
Hmm. Yeah, I've never even seen one at an air show or anywhere.
Yeah, and unlike being in San Diego, where you're used to seeing military aircraft fly overhead, here we don't get them all that often. So it definitely startled several of the folks in the neighborhood.
I bet. Now we have a report from our reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He spoke with Mark Vick, Chief Air Traffic Control Division at Robert Gray Army Airfield in Fort Hood, Texas. And they talk about ATIS, Automatic Terminal Information Service. So here they are.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. And I'm here with our special guest,
Mark Vick, Chief Air Traffic Control, Fort Hood, Texas.
And we're up here in this great big tower overlooking
Robert Gray Army Airfield, Killeen Fort Hood Regional Airport.
We're here to talk about ATIS, which is the Automatic Terminal Information Services. Let's talk about why we have it. Back in the old days, Mark, how did we used to do this?
Back in the old days, it would be a recording where a controller went in and read the weather off and put it on a system, or the controller actually issued it to the pilot off the weather screen. He would read it in the advanced approach information to the pilot coming to the airport to land.
Right. So in the old days, every time somebody broke squelch to you, you'd have to read them the same information. Then you got smart and started putting it on a tape loop on a different frequency.
Correct. That's how we do it.
And as you can hear, we are in a live tower. All right, Mark, what information is required to be put out? And is that in a set order? Is that dictated, or is that just by common practice?
No, it is in a set order by the Air Traffic Control Bible, 7110.65, the content that needs to be put out in a correct order. And the correct order for getting the information, the ATIS broadcast, airport facility name, phonetic letter code, time of the latest weather sequence, weather information, wind direction, velocity, visibility, obstruction to vision. And then you get in present weather conditions, sky condition, temperature, dew point, altimeter, density, altitude, and when appropriate, other pertinent remarks, including the official weather observation.
All right. Well, then let's listen to one.
Robert Gray Army Airfield, information foxtrot, special weather at 1931 Zulu, automated observation, wind 360 at 11, visibility 10, ceiling 700 overcast, temperature 12, dew point 10, altimeter 29998, pressure altitude plus 959, density altitude plus 998, runway 33 in use. Expect ILS approach, runway 33. Attention all aircraft, moderate bird activity in the vicinity of Robert Gray Army Airfield. Use caution during landing and takeoff. Taxiway Alpha and Bravo closed at approach end, runway 15. Warning, runway 33, departure end has been shortened. Landing distance available, 7,702 feet. Takeoff distance available, 7,900 feet. Advise on initial contact. You have information, Foxtrot.
All right. And we noticed there were some pretty special instructions at the end of this one about runway shortages or shortening.
Well, here right now we're doing runway construction. The first 1,000 feet of the runway is closed. And then we have a safety zone and then a displaced threshold. So the information we have to give out is the shortened runway information, which is different based on the, which runway you're departing off, which one you're landing, if you back taxi or if you don't back taxi. There's different numbers used. So you'll hear that information on the ATIS too, along with bird advisories. We're having moderate problem with birds right now. So we'll put that all pertinent information on the ATIS so the pilot gets to hear it there, too.
Because it's the shortened runway is covered in the NOTAMs, but for runway distance, you want to reinforce that?
Yes, we want to reinforce it so everybody is aware that the runway is shortened and we're not using the full 10,000 feet as of right now.
Now, as is policy, we all, us private pilots, know that every time we contact you, we have to tell you the last identifier of the ATIS we got into.
Correct. You check in. When you check in with us, you give us the ATIS information that you got. We verify with what's being broadcast. And if it's correct, we'll tell you Roger, and we'll move on to the rest of the information we're going to give you. If not, we'll either ask you to go back and get it, or we'll give it to you.
All right. Well, this is the Airplane Geek, so let's get geeky and talk about the hardware for a moment. This looks like a straight-up Windows box.
It does. It comes into a Windows box, but it starts on an FMQ-23 sensor, which then is set to the FMQ-23 server, which then is uploaded to a JET server, which the Air Traffic Control AAAS IDS-5 system interfaces with to pull the weather, which then is put into a StarCaster ATIS program that it comes into and puts the weather. Then after that's all done, we look at it, verify it's correct. We test it, we listen to it, and then we hit broadcast to enter it out to change the code, and that changed the weather. Because you might get spiders on the sensor, you might get a bird that lands on a sensor, so we have to verify everything's correct, or a cloud that sits, just one cloud sits low over the top of the sensor, so we have to validate that everything's correct before we hit the actual broadcast and it is sent out to the pilots.
Now, here at Robert Gray, you have sensors located where?
At both ends of the runway, 15 and 33.
Okay, and then it pulls all the weather from the weather squadron and from the FAA's weather systems?
Yes, it's used by the sensor for the PAPIs. Whatever we have the runway set in, the runway in use, it will use the appropriate sensor based on what we have the PAPIs turned on to.
Okay. And yeah, having a bird sit on your sensor could give you some weird...
Oh, it will. It very much will. You'll have where the visibility is 3 miles and you can see unrestricted. It'll change it. Spider webs will do the same thing.
All right. That's kind of interesting. Have you ever had the system collapse where you had to start backing it up by yourself?
Yes, we've had to do that. Then we'll just issue it out old school, right out through the radio. We'll read the weather right to you off the system until we get the automated system back up.
And when the automated system is automatically upgrading, you listen to it and have to hit yes before it changes over, correct?
Yes, we listen to it, we hear it. Then when we hit broadcast, it goes to another box that has a loop recording in it that is tied into the radio and continues the radio frequency going out with the ATIS, and it will not update until we hit broadcast.
And now you know a little bit more about ATIS. All right. Again, I want to thank Mark, who's been gracious enough to talk to us. He's the senior FAA controller here at Gray Army Airfield, and this is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Robert Gray, Army Airfield, information Mike, special weather at 2018 Zulu, sky conditions severe, clear, visibility unlimited. Advise on initial contact, you have information Mike, what you got by listening to Airplane Geeks podcast.
All right, thanks Launchpad. So Rob, this is a service that you and Max T use in your flying?
Well, I think certainly ATIS has been around for a long time. I mean, when I learned to fly, and maybe some other people on the frequency learned to fly, I mean, you checked in with the tower and they would just tell you landing runway 22, the wind's 220 at 8 knots, altimeter 2997. And then they repeated it over and over and over and over again as each new aircraft came in. So, of course, the ATIS was designed to make that easier. But now automating the process is really neat. And, Bill, I'm sure you can probably tell that when you hear that voice, it doesn't sound like those early automated ATISes that we'd hear at some of the larger terminals that sounded like an absolute robot.
Yeah, the early ones were Stephen Hawking. Like now I don't really hear it much at all because we get it digitally. We get it in
that's right. Yeah.
Text format. And in fact, the A350 has a function where it'll automatically update. So instead of just keep checking to see if the new ATIS came in, when a new ATIS is available, it automatically uplinks to the airplane and will display for us. So that's a nice feature.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Again, thanks Launchpad Marzari and Mark Fick. All right, a couple of quick shout-outs. First, Micah, our main man Micah, surfaced this on Twitter. Rolls-Royce Ultra fan, the ultimate jet engine. Now, you may recall that this is a Rolls-Royce project for a large geared turbofan-type engine that is under development. Well, this is a Lego model of that. Now, it's not a scale model. But it is a Lego model, and it does move. It's kind of a cutaway. Now, we'll have a couple of links in the show notes. One is to the, well, it describes the project. I know what Lego does is that if someone develops a new Lego object, in this case a jet engine, Lego puts it out there for people to essentially vote on and say if they think this should someday be worthy of becoming an actual Lego product that you can buy. And I think it's out there in that context. And then we also have a link to a video on Twitter that Andrew Smythe took that shows this Lego engine actually turning. So look for those in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/490.
I just, in honor, as much as I would like to vote for it, in honor of our host, I just can't bring myself to buy a Lego Rolls-Royce engine. Now, if it was a Pratt Whitney, just saying.
Okay, appreciated.
But I did vote for it.
This thing is huge, dude. This is just spectacular. Also wanted to mention that the 9 Aviation and Space Achievement nominations for the 2017 Collier Trophy have been announced. And we have an AOPA article that describes the nominees. The Collier Trophy, the Robert J. Collier Trophy, is an incredibly prestigious award in the aviation and space arena. The nominees are an interesting mix. I'll just go through them quickly. The Boeing 737 MAX, the Cirrus Vision Jet, Edwards Air Force Base F-35 Integrated Test Force, the NASA JPL Cassini Project Team, the Perlan Project, TSA, ALPA, and A4A known crew member in TSA pre-check programs. Also, the U.S. Marine Corps Office of Naval Research and Aurora Flight Sciences AACUS Autonomous Helicopter System. The Vanilla Aircraft VA-001, that's a long endurance unmanned aircraft. And also the Z Aero Division of Kitty Hawk Corporation, which I think that's Larry Page's, the Google co-founder, Larry Page's flying car company.
Yes, they're doing that work here in Silicon Valley.
Right, right. So those are the nominees. The selection committee meets March 22nd this year, 2018, and they'll announce the recipient of the award the following day. The actual presentation takes place June 14th, but they haven't picked a location for that yet. But you can learn more about all this either at naa.aero or at some of the links we'll have in the webpage.
Let me just throw out a couple of comments on that, if I may.
Sure.
Yeah, I was on the 2015 selection committee for the Collier Trophy. End of that year, we selected the JPL Dawn project. I saw an interesting article that came out from Robert Goyer, who is Plane and Pilot magazine article, and he came up with his analysis. And at the bottom, he said, "And the winner is the Boeing 737 MAX." And I'm not yet. Well, so I'm going to go on the record and say, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, it's certainly possible. But I think that he may have dismissed a couple of things. For example, he mentioned two different projects, the Aurora Sciences autonomous helicopter, which he basically said, helicopter without a pilot. And then the vanilla aero drone. Again, he said, okay, it's not going to win. It's a glider and a drone. I think both of those actually have a reasonable shot, and I point to a drone that has won in the past, which was
the X-47B.
Yes, exactly right. So I think Robert may be understating the chance that drones have to operate. I think he's right on that the Cirrus Vision Jet stands a shot. So, and I think the Perlin Glider project, frankly,
yeah,
those projects are the kind of revolutionary kinds of things that I think tend to win the what I consider the Nobel Prize of Aviation, and a lot of people have called it that. I think that his announcement of the 737 MAX, he might be right, but I don't think so.
It's a 737. They've been around since the 50s, the 60s, I should say.
It's a longer cart on the same horse, isn't it?
For sure, they may be correct in saying that it's the lowest cost single aisle, you know, aircraft that's been produced. But is that revolutionary? I'm not sure that it is.
Mm. Yeah, I'd forgotten, Max, that you had been on the committee a couple of years ago, which that was a fascinating experience, I think.
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, I was quite honored to do it, and it would talk about fun, and it was just kind of fun to be on the kind of the inside watching how it all happens.
A couple of years ago, a friend of mine called me and said he had an extra ticket to the Collier event, which was at the time honoring the 787. He said, "You want to come? We've got a seat at the table. You just have to get a tux." And I said, "Okay." And I went, and oh my gosh, what a cool bash. That year they had it at Reagan National Airport, and it was just, it was so worth it. So if you ever get the opportunity, go to the party.
That sounds wonderful.
Should we cast our own votes now and see who could pick the winner?
Oh, why not? I think that's a fun idea.
I'm going to go with the Perlin project myself.
Are people familiar with the Perlin project? I mean, I've seen it and I've been in the simulator for it. It's a quite amazing. The goal is to get it up to 90,000 feet, you know, in the upper air wave near tip of South America. It's been over 35,000 feet, or maybe it's 50,000 feet so far.
Yeah, 52,000.
Pretty amazing. But I think that's going to be hard to beat.
Rob, do you have a favorite?
I don't know. It's going to be a tough one. I'd like to see Cirrus's Vision Jet get it, but I don't think it has a chance, even though it is somewhat revolutionary for them. I would probably go with the Perlin project, but... again, I'm not on the selection committee. I think we should beat up Max West and find out what he knows.
Yeah. No, I certainly don't know. Who else hasn't voted here?
I haven't. I think I should go with my hometown and go with the Cassini project, but my vote's still really going to be with the Perlin project. I think that is worthy of winning.
All right, David, what do you think? Or what's your guess?
Out of all of them?
Yeah.
The most sophisticated out of all of them is the Edwards Air Force Base F-35 Integrated Test Force. Hmm. Just because when they say integrated, you're talking Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, Norway, Japan. Every country that's operating the F-35 has people in that integrated test force. It's a truly international program.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Wait
soon.
A minute. I got to cast my vote.
Oh. Sorry.
So I'm just kind of looking over the past years, and we've had something space related in 2015, 2016. You know, it's been a few years since we've had good old, you know, airplane looking things out there. So I think that bodes well for the Cirrus Jet. So I'm going to go ahead and say that it's Cirrus Jet, though I totally agree. The other the ones you mentioned there, I really like Perlin. I think that's great. But I think there are a number of good bets in there.
And, of course, if you want to hear more about the Perlin project, we had our guest, Nevildson, on episode 357 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. So we talked about the Perlin project in that episode. All right. Well, we need to get on to a little bit of the listener mail before we close out. We heard from Patrick. He wrote and said, I very much enjoyed your segment with NASA historian Bill Berry. I hope you'll have him on again. Okay, we will. he says, I grinned a bit, well, maybe more like grimaced, when y'all mentioned the complaints about the Humanity Star satellite. As one who takes literally tens of thousands of pictures every year looking for minor planets and supernovae, I know the irritation that a satellite causes when it photobombs a picture. As for seeing Humanity Star, you mentioned their site, but I'd like to suggest another, he says. This is Heavens Above. This is really cool. It's heavens-above.com. And this is a great site. You can find not only that particular satellite, the Humanity Star satellite, but you can also find where the International Space Station is, the Hubble Space Telescope, Iridium Flares, pretty much every satellite up there. He says, and if you want, they'll even send you a daily email with information on what's coming up for that evening or the next morning based on your location. Very cool. So that's from Utah, Patrick. Patrick, of course, is the NASA JPL Solar System Administrator to Utah. And Patrick sends us lots of information. In fact, he also sent us another email that is a link to a BBC article. The 101-year-old woman who flew Spitfires in World War II. It's a short video, a minute 47 seconds. Mary Ellis, the last surviving female pilot from World War II. She joined the Air Transport Auxiliary after she heard an advertisement looking for women pilots on BBC radio. And she was one of those folks who delivered Spitfires and bombers to the front line. She's now active in encouraging young women to get involved in flying. So very cool. Give this one a look. It's a nice short video. Just an amazing woman. It brought a tear to my eyes, actually, when I watched this. And then Tom wrote us and said that while it seems like an oddity, the 737-700, which is something we talked about last time, was actually one of the consistent sellers in the 737 line. Southwest Airlines bought most of them. The -700 is the same size as the -300, so the equipment was consistent for Southwest. He said Southwest only had 25 737-500s, the smallest of the NGs, which were the same size as the 737-200s, the original fleet. Also, the smallest and most popular BBJ is based on the -700. He says Southwest Airlines didn't start buying the -800s until about the time the MAX was announced in 2011. I believe the -8 and -9 will outsell the -7s by a wide margin, but there will still be a place for the -7s. And that's from Tom. And then finally, Rob wrote us and sent an article from ABC in Australia. MH370 Malaysia military sidelines crash investigators as power play emerges on search team. Wow, this is a kind of a complex story. But just briefly, and I'll quote this, four civilian air crash investigators, including the lead authority on analyzing black box flight data, have been sidelined over reported budget constraints. The Malaysian military wants to replace them with seven Royal Malaysian Air Force fighter and helicopter pilots with far less crash investigation experience. So there's a big sort of controversy swirling around that. But this is even better. Apparently, this search ship that's now out there has been the center of some conspiracy theories. So the ship turned off its transponder for 80 hours, and people are speculating as to why that is, because you've been able to track online the course of this search ship, and it circled around, and then the transponder went dark, and people are wondering why that is and what was inside this circle that the ship sailed around. Was it MH370? Some people are saying that there's actually a shipwreck there that was discovered as part of the search, and there's nothing left of the ship except this big trunk. And people are wondering, I guess, so, you know, if that's what the ship is after. It's really kind of a bizarre situation. So we'll have links in the show notes to those articles. So the MH370 mystery continues and takes this new twist.
It won't be fun to find out that it was really just the janitor who unplugged it so he could plug in the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. It's like forgetting to turn off the ADS-B on your F-16, right?
People want to put lots of mystery around it. It's like, ordinary stuff happens.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you for listening. Our guest was Bill Palmer, an A350 captain and an instructor pilot and Czech airman. Bill, tell us again where we can learn more about the fantastic books that you've written.
You can find me on Amazon.com and UnderstandingAF447.com.
Very good. Show notes for this episode, as always, are at airplanegeeks.com/490. That's the episode number. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
And Brian Coleman, how do we reach you?
Our listeners can get a hold of me, just like pilot in training Nikki did, who sent me a fantastic video of her flying around the Kennedy Space Center. She did a shuttle landing approach, which was really, really fun to watch. You can send me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, it turns out you won't be able to find me as I'm flying the SR-22 back this week because I'm going to shut off the ADS-B. So, and then we can have a conspiracy theory about why Max did that.
No, obviously aliens.
Of course. I mean, is there any other explanation? You can find me at aviationnewstalk.com and just click on the contact button and send me an email or find me wherever you get your podcast.
And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, any place that has Jetwine in the name or at flyingmag.com, where I see that we just put up a cool story I had fun writing about loss of control, which is a big killer of GA pilots here in the States. So I hope people will take a look at it. But I'm glad everybody listened this week.
All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. David said, over at the UAVDigest.com, also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Good. That's it. Thanks, everybody. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, gents.
Thanks, Bill. Fun. Thanks, Bill.
A long one tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a lot of news.
Well, that was a hell of a rehearsal. I hope the live show goes well. That's
good. And Rob, I thought when you talked about loss of control, you were talking about having to do a potty break or something.
can we zap that guy with about 10,000 volts over in Pasadena? All right, Brian, you're off my Christmas list.
Did you notice this?
Into the stall warning, and has a built-in protection envelope that it tries to bring it back into the normal flight envelope. That's not quite a...
Do you know what I think that was? I think that was somebody using compressed air to clean their computer, keyboard, or something. Now, first off, that was like impossible to remove, so sorry about that. Also, I won't tell you who did it, but I'm pretty sure it was Rob.